Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
Sorry. Little mic rub like, there. Little mic rub there. Sorry.
That was like a common man rewind. I am at the offices of Rod Shera Productions, which can only mean one thing. It's time for the annual season preview with our television partner, The Flush, and host Travis Frank. This will be the 13th season.
Holy cow.
If my arithmetic is right. And I'm a youper, so don't trust it.
I don't trust you.
Yep. But I think it's the 13th season that we've been partnered together in airing The Flush on Outdoor Channel. So as we're in the middle of midsummer here, and as we, you know, before we hit record, I was like, I think I want to talk fishing.
I know it's hard. Hunting season will be here soon. It's just not quite here yet.
So obviously the person you hear it is good friend Travis Frank. We will preview the hunting season on The Flush, or the, mm-hmm. The Flush is 13 season.
13 years. How long did Friends make it? Are we approaching anything to celebrate? Wait, a major milestone?
Which characters Cheers? Would we be on? Well, pick any sitcom. Which character would you be?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you're talking Friends. I would be, I feel like, I don't know, maybe Joey? I would probably be Joey.
Joey Tribbiani.
Joey Tribbiani, yes.
I like to think of myself as Kramer. Now, mm-hmm. They're going to a Seinfeld.
Sure.
I don't know that I'm Kramer. I'm not wacky enough to be. I'm probably more like George.
George.
Look at my wallet. I've got
you
a Costanza
are. Look at
wallet.
You have a George Costanza wallet. Oh, my gosh. I love that I so do much. Know. There's no way you can sit on that.
The other
Where
thing,
do you put that when you...
I know.
You have a backpack for that wallet?
That should be the image for this podcast, right? My George Costanza.
I need to get a picture of that. my goodness, Bob. What do you have in there?
All
do
my
you have
hunting
your Garmin
licenses.
Collar, dog collar fit in there?
Look at this. I've got my hunting licenses.
From all 50 states?
I'm already...
Look at that. That's like a book.
Yeah, get the old Gander Mountain...
How long have you had this Gander Mountain isn't even open, Bob. How long have you had
Before
this?
Before they went out of business, they grabbed like 18 of those.
There are at least 30 different hunting licenses in here.
There's a bunch. And now, you know,
this is impressive.
So many of them have the cards that you can't right. throw away the license.
Or you can know. Just have it on your phone.
Well, you could. Yes, you could. I do have my Go Wild card from Wisconsin. I've got my Nebraska, my Iowa. I'm not one that... I don't
ever throws anything out. Away. Do you put everything in your wallet?
Here's
that
another.
That is a beauty. That is
that
impressive.
Is a well, here's my lifetime card, and this is another yep. Seinfeld George moment. I worked out. I'm working out every morning now. You know,
good for you. You're looking good.
Well, I'd like to look a little better, but yeah. You hit 50, and the metabolism just changes, right? So for about the last year and a half, every single morning I work out, and it's I want to
what
lose
are you
weight.
Doing? What are you? How are you working out?
I start off with 30 minutes of elliptical okay. to get my heart rate going, and it as I've talked about before, I'm a type 1 diabetic, mm-hmm. so trimming the weight and keeping my heart going is really important. And the thing that I realize more than anything is mentally. I feel so much better. I mean, I like sleep, but I get up at 5:45, get to the gym, work out, and my mental disposition every single day that I work out is so much better.
Good for you. Your mental side of things, you know, your mental health is so important. And I think the food that we eat and the exercise, you know, how active we are, those
and
two
sleep.
Things. Yeah,
and sleep.
Which I just turned 40, and now I'm realizing that I can't sleep as long as I used to because I have to get up and go to the bathroom, and I hate it so much. I just don't want to get up yet. And it's like, no, I'm getting up. And then, you know, maybe that's why people, as they age, they don't sleep as long because they're tired of getting up and walking into the bathroom. Okay, so
my routine is 30 minutes of elliptical, 30 minutes of weightlifting. Not, you know, hardcore, but enough to keep strength up. And then this is where I go Joe Rogan on the bit. I take like a 20-minute sauna. And
what kind of sauna do you have?
Well, just a sauna at Lifetime. But I also bought a Stoke sauna, or Meredith did, a Stoke sauna for our home that is like an outdoor electric sauna. You hit it on, you wake up in the morning, you hit it on Wi-Fi, and like 15 minutes later, it's ready to run.
How often do you use it?
A lot.
In the summer too?
Well, not so much in the summer, but
are you a cold plunger?
I don't have a cold plunge.
Just get one of those big coolers and dump some ice in there.
George St. Pierre, do you know that? Like the UFC fighter, he posts all these photos of doing the cold plunge. He's got this metal, when I was in college, they put beer in it, right?
Not anymore. But
not anymore. You cold plunge after sauna. But anyways, the sauna is just
that'll
awesome.
Be next. That'll be next.
But and where then, I was going with that, back to the Seinfeld reference, at Lifetime the last week, there was no hot water. It was all cold water in the showers, and I walked I walked out of the shower, and every like there's lineup of lockers, and it's kind of a morning community of people that see each other. Like, I feel like I'm in an episode of Seinfeld. You guys know about shrinkage, right?
The pool was cold. I love it. I have a question for you.
Yes.
If you could change your TV name, what would it be? Or if you could choose a TV name.
Will the Thrill.
Will the Thrill. Pine Cooley. That's my new TV
name. Pine Cooley.
Pine Cooley.
Where does that come from?
We just had a story meeting a couple days ago here in the office, in this exact room.
Yeah.
And there's this place in Minnesota called Pine Cooley. And as soon as I heard it, Scott Franz, and he was sitting next to me, we both looked at each other like, that is the coolest name I have ever heard. If I'm changing my name for TV, it is going to be Pine Cooley. Could you imagine that name walking through the field? It's just perfect.
It sounds like a porn star.
Or also known as a bird owner. Aren't they just
this
one in the same?
This wasn't on my outline at all.
Aren't they one in the same porn star bird hunter? You know what I mean? Pretty much identical.
Oh, I love it when conversations veered left and to the right.
That's every good podcast should have a little sidebar.
Well, so this was another sidebar we had before we recording. To use an outline or to not use an outline. I'm kind of a religious planner, maybe to my fault.
Yeah.
So I want to get your philosophy on prepping your guests with an outline, because I think I'm one of the only podcasters that I'm aware of, and I'm not trying to take credit. Most podcasters, I don't think, provide guests with an outline. And I think that's deliberate, and it might be a good reason.
I deliberately don't have questions written out for my guests because I don't want them to have it pre-planned out. I kind of like the conversational flow like we have right here right now, and I want to keep that. If I have pre-written questions, I think then it's too scripted in their mind, and it's not a natural conversation that you and I might have if we run into each other on the street. And I think that's why people enjoy podcasts, is it's a long form interview. You know, and we do a lot of television interviews, and we don't have questions written out beforehand either. I kind of explain, this is the direction we're going to go. I'll give a couple of bullet points on here's where my thought is. You know, here's what I know about you, and I'd like to ask a little bit more in depth about how you got to this point and what you've learned and why you do this. And depending on the guest, their area of expertise, we'll dig into the I go, you're going to know the answer to every one of these questions. So don't stress it. Sometimes I can tell there's a, you know, some people are asking me a lot. You know, they're nervous about it.
They've got trepidation.
Yes, they're nervous about the interview that we're going to conduct, and they don't, I've never done this before. Can you send me a list of questions? And I'll say, no worries. Don't worry about this. You're going to do great, you know, and we're just going to have a natural conversation. You know all the answers. So I don't provide a in-depth outline, and I guess maybe it's working. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've been on others and I never get an outline.
How do you feel about that?
I'm comfortable with it, though, right?
You're a pro. You've done this for, 10 years? But maybe longer?
I think I just passed, was that 16 years on KFAN?
Long already?
I know.
Holy cow,
and
Bob.
Let me tell you, Billy never provides an outline. Yeah. You know, so we never have an outline.
But those are the best conversations. And, and that's like, I got thrown into Live Outdoors on WCCO about 15 years ago. That's how long I've been here. And that was every week, live radio.
Yeah.
There were no scripts. Yep. It's live. And not like podcasting right now where if I have to go run to the bathroom, you can hit pause.
Right.
You know, if it when it's live, and then when you have listeners calling in, you have no idea what's coming. Right. Those are the best shows.
Did you know the DNR is dropping minnows out of helicopters? That's why the fish bite is not very good right now.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah, live callers are
live callers are the bomb.
But with podcasting, like I do feel... I feel that sense of trepidation from a ton of my guests on this podcast.
Sure. And
so I provide a rudimentary outline. I say, I don't want to script it, but it sort of inadvertently scripts it. You know, I figure out where the story arc of the conversation is and provide that to the guests. Like, I'm not writing out every single question, but it does feel like, gosh, there is a opportunity to go you know, off the chart a little bit more. So it's just a little bit of philosophical difference in outline, not an outline.
You've done this podcast for how long now? 6 years?
I don't know, 5, 6, something like that.
Yeah, you started a couple years before we started doing a podcast on ours as well, and I know we share a lot of the same listeners. The diehard bird hunters and dog enthusiasts, bird dog lovers. What keeps you engaged in this podcast? Every week it's another show. Every week is another show, and there are highs and lows that come with it, right? I mean, what makes you excited about your next interview?
Wow, turning the tables on me. I like this is kind of my highlight of my week. Honestly, I love putting on the creative hat, and the podcast is a creative outlet for me to come up with concepts and guests, and rather than the day-to-day management of a team of 25 people and, you know, what are we going to do to meet these budget goals or sell this or do that for the organization? This is an opportunity for me to tell a story that's creative and put the spotlight on somebody. So this, it's like unlimited number of guest ideas. Right. Like, my list of possibilities are huge.
Do you have a favorite show? And have you ever gone back and listened to your first episode?
I haven't gone back and listened. My first episode was The Anatomy of a Land Acquisition with Aaron Sandquist. That was episode number one. Like, how does Pheasants Forever buy land and make it, you know, public access? And that was really important, probably time for a dusting off
maybe
and a
have
refresh.
Him back on again.
When it asked what my favorite episode is, I always go back to the Dennis Anderson episode. You know, just kind of the origin story of Pheasants Forever back in, you know, 1982, and Dennis telling the story of writing this newspaper article and people sending him money in envelopes saying, start it. To me, like, if I point somebody back to go back and listen to an episode of On the Wing, that's the one I'll immediately point to as kind of the best one.
Love
and
it.
You also can learn a lot about the organization too.
Sure. I was going to have more follow-up questions, but I figure I'll let you take
here. what about you? What's your favorite episode?
Oh, I really can't pick just one. I feel like I'm always looking at the next one. Or being trying to keep myself in the moment with this one. And sometimes I'll come into it, Bob, and if I'm being honest, I'm like, gosh, I don't know about this one. This might not be that good. And then all of a sudden, if you let the story unfold, you can bring yourself into it. And you're part of it then. And then I love it. And I'm like, that ended up being awesome. You know, it surprised the heck out of me. I took my son hunting on the road last year, and we filmed his first pheasant hunt. And then afterwards, we sat down and I put the headset on him and I just started talking to him and asking him questions about hunting. And he was 9 at the time. Mm. And we relived some of those moments together out in the field. And then he just has his own little wit about him. And some of his responses to my questions were just like, oh, buddy, I love that so much. You know, I asked him, like, who's cooking do you like better on the pheasant? Or who makes a better mm-hmm. pheasant, mom or dad? He goes, no comment. You know, things like that, because he knew he didn't want to offend either one of us. But like, oh, gosh. And it was such a rich time, Bob. It was... Mm. It was one of those experiences where I was really torn because I have to produce TV. Mm-hmm. That's my son, his first pheasant hunt. And I don't know that I want to mix the two things mm-hmm. together.
Yep.
And so I was nervous out there because you don't get that first time experience back.
Yeah.
And I also have to make sure that I'm doing my job here mm-hmm. and keeping my videographer in the right place and producing all this stuff. And there's just a lot of pressure there. And so I was torn on it, but I'm excited to share this with people. I do hope that it will make people think about bringing their kids along with them or somebody else's kids earlier in life, because I just don't think there's ever a wrong time to bring somebody out. Mm. They may not be carrying the shotgun, but I've had my kids hunting alongside of me as early as 3 years old, being a part of the experience. You pick and choose those experiences, and I didn't know where it was going to lead. But right now, my son, my oldest, is 10. He just turned 10 a couple weeks ago, and last hunting season was unbelievable. He's such a good hunter. And it's fun watching him out there. And it's really amazing to see the skill that he has, you know. And I am comfortable walking next to him while he's carrying a shotgun. And he handles a gun better than, I hate to say this, but a lot of adults that I've walked the field with. He's really responsible. Gun barrel always in the right direction. Very safe with it. Totally understands the dog aspect of it, the birds. He's learning, the wheels are turning. I'm hunting through his eyes a little bit and watching him score, you know. I mean, last year it started, he got doves, and then goose hunting opened and duck hunting opened, and he got doves, geese, ducks, and he's a heck of a shot on the wing. He's dropping a teal buzzing by, you know, and boom, folds it. I'm like,
boom. At 9 years old.
Yeah. Totally. And Daisy runs out there and retrieves it and comes running back, you know, and it's just such a cool thing. My other two kids are sitting right behind us and, you know, just having these moments. I didn't even fire, you know, just to be watching and be a part of it. And then the upland season started and he got his first rough grouse. He got his first woodcock, you know, watching, going in on a point together. He's on one side, I'm on the other, and the first couple explosions just knocked him back, you know, and there were no birds taken, and then I dropped one, and then he got to see, you know, I mean, because he's walked alongside, but this is the first year carrying a shotgun. And then we went out to North Dakota together and we did that pheasant hunt together, and he took his first pheasant. There were ups and downs because there were misses, but that's to be expected, and that's, you know, really the rich part of it is the journey, not the end result.
Any regrets to filming that first hunt?
I don't know. I don't think so. But everything hasn't played out yet. So
what do you mean?
Well, the show hasn't aired yet. The episode isn't done, and I don't know.
In terms of editing it and viewers' reaction.
Sure.
But you were there. You experienced everything.
Yeah, no. I would 100% encourage anybody to go do that. Yeah, that's why I'm airing the episode. That's why we went to film the episode. I just think it's such an amazing experience if you can bring your kids along on a hunt. And there are a lot of people that I know that they schedule these trips, and it's their buddies, and it's not necessarily their wives or their kids. And I just think that there can be room for both. If you can do it, bring your kids earlier than later. Because as I'm experiencing now, a 9-year-old is a very smart, and not all my kids are going to be on the same trajectory. Mm. And I understand that, but he's there and he's ready for it. So I don't want to make him wait any longer. I want that drive to want to hunt, to keep fueling that. And I don't want to take away from those guy trips or those girl trips, you know, because those are important too.
Yeah.
Because we connect out there on the land, and it's healthy to have those experiences with buddies, but it's also a great thing to bring in your wives or your husbands if you're a lady that hunts. I mean, it is a great thing to bring your partner along, to bring your kids along, and show them as well.
Yeah. My perception is the episode that you've gotten the most feedback from historically was when you did bring your wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
On that sharptail hunt in Montana, right?
That one was on the grass, South Dakota, on the grasslands of South Dakota along the banks of the Missouri River. And it was a horseback hunt, and it was just one of those experiences where she and I still talk about it. Mm. We're actually figuring out where we're going to go this hunting season together. But I still, at Pheasant Fest or when I'm out and about, people are still talking about that episode. Mm-hmm. And they tell me their own stories about taking their wives along, or now my wife hunts because of that.
Yeah.
And to me, it just blows my mind. So that's why I look back at this hunt with my son, and mm-hmm. I'm hoping that people will say, I can take my son hunting now too. My dad did not bring me bird hunting. We didn't have a bird dog as a kid. Yeah. I did not go on bird hunting trips. And you couldn't hunt deer in Minnesota until you were 12 by state law mm-hmm. at that time. So think of all those years that I could have been out there hunting small game. You know, in Minnesota, my son can be right there next to me hunting at that age. And a couple weeks ago, both my boys got turkeys, you know, or a couple months ago now. But, you know, together. And my little girl sitting next to us, too. And so 9, 8, and 6-year-old sitting in there. And then my mom came with. Mm. And she likes to come out and be a part of it. She loves the outdoor experience. With turkeys in particular, you're talking to them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put a – I think I got the biggest blind sportsman guide cells because I have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. There's 5 of us in the blind
really?
Together. You know, and we just – I've – adapted my hunting to that, and when they are a part of the experience, oh my goodness, it's a lifestyle for us. We eat the food together. I'm talking about the land. Mm-hmm. We're talking to the wild animals out there. We're watching the pheasant, you know, cackle, and they're like, wow, he sounds terrible. Yeah, well, he's looking for love, you know, and we get to talk about all these natural things that are happening out there, and they're taking it all in. And, you know, I let my kids work the call together. And so for them to be able to communicate with the wild bird and then also just really understand the land and what it takes for those birds to live there, I believe is a very important part of their journey to, because we've talked about this a lot, Bob, and, you know, even on stage at Pheasant Fest last year, there's going to be a day when they're going to be the ones making decisions for the land.
Yep.
And if they don't know anything about it or they don't care,
why
should we expect them to make the decisions that matter?
What about the hunter education process? Did your kids go through a formal setting or
I've done it
you
since.
You did it with them online sort of thing?
No, because in Minnesota, you can't be hunter certified until you're 11 years old.
Okay.
That's when you can take the class for the first time.
Okay.
So they still have to wait. To which I'm like,
okay, so they're going as mentor-mentee with you?
Yeah, basically.
Got it.
There's no age requirement for a small game license. So turkeys, ducks, geese, pheasants, grouse, everything, squirrels, rabbits, they all fall into the small game category.
Okay.
So basically, and I literally called the DNR trying to understand all these laws in our state here. And then I've called now in other states, too, to understand. South Dakota does it way different than Minnesota.
Hmm.
In South Dakota, if you want to take a kid under the age of 12, I believe, they are going to be shooting birds on your limit. You do not get to carry a shotgun with them.
Wow.
And so they're the hunter. You have to be within basically like arm's reach of them, and you're their mentor in the field out there. So Weston and I were going to go and hunt in South Dakota, but I changed my plans when I was trying to make sure that I'm doing everything 100% legally, mm-hmm. you know, correct. But I did not want to put that kind of pressure on him. Yeah. Here's a cameraman, and now it's all about you.
Yeah.
You know, everything we've done in life, outdoor related, has been together. And that experience is something that we do together. If I put all that pressure on him, that's a lot, especially at a young age. If I take a bird, and he's just as excited if I get a bird too. So we ended up going to North Dakota, where the laws are like Minnesota. I go online and get a license for him, and it's a very inexpensive license for young kids. And he can hunt on his own. I can hunt with him. We're together, but I can also carry a shotgun, and I can shoot birds. He can shoot birds under his own limit.
Wow.
And so therefore, we're just hunting together. We're hunting buddies, you know, and we're doing it together, and that takes a little bit of pressure off.
Yeah.
And that's, I'm happy that we went that route. But same thing here in Minnesota. Now, this fall, he's going to be able to go deer hunting as a 10-year-old. There's a youth season, and we've started early in life. I mean, he was interested in the outdoors because of my interest in the outdoors, exposing him to it. And in our family, it's normal. This isn't like a once a year opening day or anything where we do it once and then that goes away and it's back to just sports. Our lifestyle is outdoor, active, outdoor, and we do sports too. We love sports, but it's just who we are. We eat wild game. We harvest our own food, and it's just a family thing. So early in life, it started with the BB gun. We hit cans, targets, and then upgraded to a 22. And then I got a hand-me-down youth model 20-gauge shotgun. And I also had a friend hand me down a youth, a 410. But I found that the 20-gauge is actually a shorter stock, fits their arms a little better. And so Weston, he was all about it. That first shot almost knocked him back. And, you know, I was holding, sitting in my lap with him and wanted, you know, when I wasn't sure he was ready, but he said he was ready. And I said, we'll try a paper target with the 20 gauge. And he couldn't load another shell in fast enough to take another shot. So that didn't scare him away. Now, my other son, it scared him away. And so we waited a couple more years until he was ready to try it again because it was stuck in the back of his head. And I learned valuable lessons there by how I introduced it to each one of those kids. And, you know, that gunshot scares them, scared Cash, not Weston. And the reason was when Cash took a shot, his at the last second, the first time I shot with him on my lap, and I held that gun real tight, so there wasn't that kick that hurt. When he went to pull the trigger, he kind of adjusted at the last second, and there was he didn't have it snug, so then it hit his arm and scared him. And that was the lasting memory. As soon as that happened, I was like, oh, no, oh, no. Here we go, buddy. Let's do another one real quick. Like, I wanted his last memory to be a positive one, but he held on to that negative shot, and that stuck with him for years. He's finally moved past that, but that was a lesson learned there, and now I'm going to apply that with my daughters when they get ready to take the shot too. I think I got a sidetracked here. I'm sorry.
No, this is wonderful because obviously I don't have kids, and it's really interesting to see it through a father's eyes, and I'm hopeful that a lot of listeners out there that are young moms and dads that want kids to experience something similar, hear your words, and your perception, I think, is probably the most important thing, not forcing it, right? Like being cognizant of how each son or daughter is experiencing each step of the process and being aware enough to recognize, okay, let's put a pause on that. And it may be a pause for a couple of years.
Yeah, you just have to read the room with the kids, and that's what I'm trying to do. And I don't want to force outings. So my oldest now is obsessed with hunting and fishing like I am. We could go hunt and fish every day, and he would want more. And to me, that's great. Now, I've held his hand through a lot of these steps. I'm at a point where, buddy, like, you have to struggle now. You're going to need to fail, which is an important part of the hunting journey as well. Same with fishing. I mean, I have friends that they're, you know, really good anglers, and their kid you know, I had this story, Jason Mitchell. I think you know Jason out in North Dakota there. He's got a TV show, and I had him as a guest on one of our podcasts a year and a half ago, and he said something that really landed with me, and he goes, my son does not like to fish. He loves to trap. And he goes, I don't know anything about trapping. So he had to figure it out on his own, and he had to struggle. When I took him fishing, I went to the best spot. Drop your line down, you pull up a walleye. Drop your line down, you pull up a walleye. There's no failing in that. I've done a lot of those same things with my kids. I take them as a fishing guide for 25 years on these waters. I've got a pretty good pulse on where they're going and why, because that's just the way my brain works. And I'll take them to a spot and be like, all right, cast right there.
Yeah.
And then I know there's...
Oh, I know. I've been in a boat.
Yeah. Like, they're right there.
It's almost like cheating.
Well, sort of. I don't know. But anyway, so don't reel. Let it fall. Yeah. And then I can see a tick in the line.
Yeah.
Okay, set the hook. You know, I've basically done everything for them. There's no failing. I'm done with that. They're on their own now. He's on his own. Now I'm grooming my other kids, you know, and trying to help them. And they're able to do a lot of these things on their own. But failing is a big part because you and I, we love this outdoor space. We have failed a lot. And that's a good thing, and still do. And it makes you want to go back out and do it again. You probably get this. I get this. People will send in messages and say, I'm out here. I'm 2 miles into this. I haven't seen a bird yet. You guys make it look like they're everywhere. What am I doing wrong? And I say, walk 5 more miles. You haven't walked far enough yet. You will figure it out, but you have to put in those miles. And then when you do... That's when you're like, oh yeah, this is sweet. And for everyone that gets away, I want them that much more. And that's the beauty of it. It's the journey. It's the ups and downs.
It is. I was, you know, we had turkey season just a little bit ago here in Minnesota, and I didn't get a turkey, right? I came close, and I talked about that on KFAN. I called one from private land to public land, talking back to me the whole way, and I was set up in kind of rough grouse country, so it was really thick, and that bird was probably 40 yards away. So, and people were 40 yards, and you didn't I couldn't even see it at 40 yards. Oh, I was thick stuff, and I had a decoy in a deer trail, and I, for whatever reason, either the decoy scared the bird away, or my purring was not as good as my yelping. And I never saw it. I just never committed and just kind of slinked away. And I didn't get a turkey. And I got so much feedback from that story. It told in a little longer, but from telling a story of not having, you know, success. Well, that's the wrong way of phrasing it. Not bagging a bird. I still had a great time, right? But people are like, well, I never hear about people talking about not getting what they're after, you know, whether it's on outdoor television shows, radio shows, social media. Is like everybody gets something like, well, that's not reality.
That's not reality.
Plenty of times go out pheasant hunting, grouse hunting, quail hunting, and you get skunked, sometimes literally skunked,
sprayed
by a skunk. But a lot of times, you know, wild birds and wild places, especially when you're traveling, and that's part of the charm of Rooster Road Trip.
Yeah.
You know, you just show up and you're like, well, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, last year you guys did really well down there in Iowa.
Yeah, we had a pretty good trip. We had one day where all we shot was a woodcock, though, in southern Minnesota. And I love woodcock.
Same here. That recipe you shared when we were up in that Wisconsin grouse camp, I have shared it with so many people. I love woodcock now because of that. And it's the most simple thing you could ever do.
Really?
Yeah. Have you shared it on the show?
I don't think so.
Well, do it now. Do it right now.
Well, all it is a little bit of olive oil
and
then the spicy Montreal steak seasoning.
Yep.
Sprinkle that on, and then it's what? 2 minutes aside on a grill. And
maybe not even. Depending on how hot.
Eat it rare.
Yep.
And it tastes like beef tenderloin, honestly.
It's a tenderloin. Exactly how I explain it to people. And as soon as they have it, they're like, hot damn, I'm never passing up a woodcock ever again. Yes, exactly. It's so good. I really think, and you know this, Bob, because you love the wild game food like I do. most wild game that isn't delicious is overcooked.
Yeah, cooked wrong.
You know, I don't know why people think because it's a wild animal, they need to cook it longer to make sure it's safe to eat. You've ruined it.
Sharptails, exact same recipe.
Yeah.
Like, exact same as what I just said for woodcock, and you just do it. Especially if you do it that night. I mean, it's
a little olive oil on those birds, and then whatever seasoning you want, and medium rare or rare, and you're good to go. Eat it up, eat it fresh, eat it out in the field.
Speaking of, how did you prepare your son's Weston's first bird, first pheasant? Do you remember?
Well, so this is another story. Do we got 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. So the last probably 4 years, we've done a dad's and daughters and sons MEA camp up north. And this is where I go to deer and grouse hunt. My buddy has a cabin up in the woods up there. And now there's like five or six of us that bring not all of our kids, but when the kids are old enough. And so I think we had like 8 or 9 kids in camp last year. My nephew, who's now 12, so he's deer hunted the last 2 years. So we deer hunt, we waterfowl hunt, we grouse and woodcock hunt all over the course of MEA weekend, which is it's become the best weekend of my entire year, I swear. And it is so much fun. We have this little cabin in the woods. All these kids come together, boys and girls, and we do a little bit of everything, and we do it together. So we walk out into a sharptail field with these kids, and we all gather around, and they're all in blaze orange hats or vests, and a couple of them now, three of them are old enough to shoot. And so we walk together. We have a couple of dogs out there, and I explain them, like, this is the habitat that they like and why, and they're native birds to this area. And then we go out, and I say, when they flush, sometimes they're going to flush all at once, and here's what the dog's going to do. And a couple of these are first-time kids coming with, you know, on dad's shoulders type of thing. We get one bird, and it is a massive celebration. We all come together. Mm. Those kids touch the bird. I open up the crop. Here's what they're eating. Now we can look for more of this. And they are – it is like the most incredible classroom you have ever been in. These kids are so locked in. They touch every part of the bird. They just can't wait to clean it. So anyway, getting back to the food part.
Yeah.
This last year we had sharptail grouse, we had rough grouse, we had woodcock, and then my nephew got a deer. Seven of us in the deer stand together. I had two dads and there were me and another dad and then five kids in the stand together when my nephew pulled the trigger and got a deer. And wow, did the crowd go wild. These kids, you talk about a classroom. They were crazy about it. So then we have wild game dinners at the cabin. And that particular night after the kids, three of the kids got their first rough grouse that day. And Weston got woodcock that day. So we had woodcock. We shot a goose that morning. So we had one goose.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, so we had sharptail grouse, woodcock, rough grouse, a goose, and deer tenderloins for dinner that night. And we made them in a bunch of different ways. And the woodcock we made like you. Exactly. So we have a variety of different foods. I don't remember specifically the recipe. All I know is I had a picture of all these platters with different cuts of meat that the kids were all holding, and they all just hammered it. They're like, we need more. We need more grouse. We need more geese. We need another deer. I mean, like, there was like 14 of us at the table in between the dads and all the kids, and then a couple of the neighbors come over. It's become the richest weekend. You know, we do a little ATV riding, but we're tired at the end of it. I mean, we go hard, but every bird, every success is like this massive group win. And so when we get one, we're like, that's it. Anything beyond that is
cool,
is amazing, but unnecessary. Now we have one. And so eating it has become, the only thing that we come home with is the deer, because we can't eat the whole deer over the course of a
weekend. But it's a tremendous celebration, and it brings the hunt completely full circle.
It does, yep. Yeah. And so the kids are learning about the land. They're learning about the birds. You know, we talk about it, but I'm amazed at how much they take in. And even their love for the dogs now, you know, and how they watch the dogs. Like, oh, Daisy's on point. Daisy's on point, you know. And so
there's an army of seven going up on the point.
So we'll demonstrate. The first time she goes on point, I'm going to demonstrate. Guys, I want you to watch. They're not carrying with the loaded gun. They're walking in on it. Okay. So now, because there's multiple people in the field, this is a challenge, you know. So anytime we get a bird in hand with nine people, you know, right. Like, so I'll go in and demonstrate. Now they see it. All right, you're up next. We'll take turns. We'll do, you know, one, my nephew and my friend's daughter, she'll go in and they'll go one on each side, and we load the gun after the dog goes on point and they walk in and birds maybe run. Or, these are wild birds. You don't know what's going to happen, you know, but when they get them, oh my goodness. Like, it is just, it is unbelievable. Magic. It's magic. There you go. Yeah. It's magic.
So the pheasant, did you eat the pheasant as part of that group then? With the, your son's first pheasant.
That was just he and I in North Dakota together.
So the meal, did you eat it with that group or did you eat it that night?
That one I did, I do the legs with a similar recipe where it's just olive oil and then a little spicy, I forget what kind it is. Walton's has a seasoning. It's like the pheasant. I don't know what exactly.
Rooster booster or something.
Something like that. It's like
rooster
pheasant roast. And quail or I don't know, but it's really, really good. And then it's kind of that spicy Montreal as well. Okay. That on the grill, medium. I think the legs are the best part of the bird. Mm. So many people, I don't know why, but, you know, they just breast them out, and then the legs are thrown away. And I'm like, bring them over. Don't throw them away because they're so good. And I think I did bacon wraps with the breasts on his first bird out there. So we had them both ways. And, you know, like you're at, like, the state fair, and you got somebody walking around with the big turkey. Like, that's him gnawing on his rooster leg out
this
there.
This is great, Dad. Let's go do it again.
Exactly, exactly. Can we go get more tomorrow? Yeah. We're going to try, buddy. We're going to try. So he's a big fan of wild game. Whenever I – at home when we're preparing it. And my wife has really embraced it, too. Bless her. She – goes and does a lot of research on recipes, and so we're always trying something new. Lately, it's been sharptail pizza, pheasant pizzas. She's really gotten into making her own dough, and all of the ingredients are wild ingredients, natural, and including the birds that we harvest. And that, you know, because, like, she invests so much into making all this food that she doesn't want any to go to waste, which is the same way I feel about. Right. I don't want one little piece of meat to get tossed out. Because I know what went into getting that bird, right. You know, and it's so special to me. And I feel like a lot of people get disconnected from their food because there's no connection to it.
Yeah.
They didn't grow any of the greens. They didn't harvest the meat. They didn't raise the beef or whatever. They press a button on their phone and it shows up on their front step.
Yeah.
There's zero connection to that food. When you harvest it, you take care of it. You know, like my garden right now, I go out and I look at it every day. I can't get enough of that garden right now. I know what's coming, you know, and we're already can't wait to have this mixed with this. And there's such a, like, it's weird to say this, but there's such a connection to that food. You don't want to waste any of it. Whereas if you press that button and it shows up on your step and now you're like, I can't eat any more of that. I'm just going to throw the rest away.
Yeah, I 100% agree with, and I know that there's listeners out there that, okay, here we are, middle of summer. They still have birds in the freezer, you know, it's like.
Maybe they're just really good hunters, Bob.
Well, and if there's a public service announcement to be had in this episode, it's like, get in that freezer and thaw that stuff out right now. Don't let it die another death of freezer burn.
Yeah.
Get it out. Get it ready for the grill. Slow cook it in a crock pot and pull that meat off and make, you know, pheasant leg sandwiches, which it absolutely, have you done that? Like, just slow cook crock pot. Legs, pull the meat off, put it in like macaroni salad.
It falls
salad.
Off. Yeah, it falls off the bone. It's like a pulled pork sandwich, basically. You can do that with the legs.
Pull the meat off, put it in like, you could do, like you say, like barbecue sauce and pulled pork pheasant sandwiches.
I'm getting hungry now.
You could do the pheasant leg meat like with mayo, elbow macaroni or circle macaroni and dried cherries and cashews. Ooh. Like that pasta salad that you would have on the side of a sandwich in middle of summer. Like, get it out of the freezer and put it to work.
Yeah.
Don't let it die.
No kidding. I would love, and this would be a goal of mine, maybe when I retire I can accomplish this, but I want to eat my own harvested food every day.
Yeah.
Maybe it's Walleye Wednesday. It could be Tenderloin Tuesday of a deer. You know, it could be a bird on Fridays. I don't know what it looks
How
like.
How close are you to that right now?
Not close. I got four kids. And they eat a lot. And they're eating more all the time. I will say this. My 10-year-old, I'm looking forward to putting that extra deer in the freezer this year that his license is good for. Because I can only shoot whatever... You know, in my zone, it depends on how harsh the winters were the year before and the population. But the last couple of years, I've been able to take two deer. Mm. And we are out of venison way before hunting season on those deer.
So when are you going moose hunting?
Well, I want to go elk hunting too.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also bigger animals. I produce a television show during hunting season. And so I travel a lot and I have a young family. And my wild... personal hunting escapades have been put on hold because I spend a fair amount of time away from home during hunting season to film this TV show, and I want to make sure then that I am present for my family when I'm not on the road. So maybe it's taking them with me, and that's certainly, as I just shared, been something I look forward to, but I also know how important it is to be there. And so I've cut back my own personal getaways and time with my buddies because I just want to be present at home.
Yeah. Another idea in terms of, you know, creating your own meat, right? And, you know, you're pressed for time and you get a big family. One thing that I've done the last couple of years, there's some farmers here in Minnesota that are partnered with the DNR or with Pheasants Forever to do managed grazing on wildlife areas. And then, so whether it's cows or lambs, and then I bought like a lamb from Murray County, Minnesota, and a cow, quarter cow, from Western Minnesota, that are eating grass from habitat management on wildlife areas.
I didn't know that was a thing here.
There are places that that's happening, and you know, so it's a step removed from harvesting it. Myself,
you're still connected there,
but
though.
It's connection to it's like they're, you know, what's good for the bird is good for the herd sort of mentality.
Totally.
And I love lamb too, and thinking about, you know, eating a lamb chop that was making habitat better because it was munching on, you know, some grass.
100% conservationist. Yeah, Bob.
Well,
I love it.
I still buy a few chickens from the store too.
We got chickens at home now.
Do you really?
Yes, we have chickens too. We're just
you're on your way.
Yeah, totally. Yep, we're living off the land,
Bob. All right, Outdoor Channel, Home of the Flush. Airtime's almost the same as last year, right? With a little difference on Fridays.
I think we added a day to it. I'm not entirely sure. Here, let me look it up quick.
So I got it from, so I've got Mondays at 9:30 a.m., Wednesdays at 12:30 p.m., Fridays at 11:30 a.m., and I think that's the difference in time from last season.
It could be.
And then we got Saturdays, 8:30 a.m., Sundays at 6:30 a.m.
Yep. Yep. For the weekenders that like to wake up and watch bird hunting, we've got you covered Saturday and Sunday.
And those are Eastern time zones.
Yes.
So Central, just dial it back an hour. Mm-hmm. Pacific, 2 hours. But like you said, that those weekend time slots are probably when a lot of people are catching them.
Yeah, that, and I think people just DVR.
Right.
You know, and then they watch it on their own time.
Or you can watch past episodes on YouTube,
too. Yep, the full-length episodes in their entirety are on YouTube. Yeah. We don't air them the current season on YouTube until this entire... So, like, for instance, we're now in a new season. And the way the TV network works is they run by quarter, so 13 weeks. So we have 13 new episodes, makes up a season for us, and then that runs July, August, September, and then they repeat them again October, November, December. So after December's over, we then contractually can stream them, but we cannot air any of those episodes until the full season has run its course on the Outdoor Channel. And then, of course, if people live up in Canada, their episodes are airing on Wild TV.
Right.
And we also have another show called Rooster Tales that airs on Sportsman's Channel and Bally Sports. So we try to make sure that people, wherever they're able to get their outdoor programming, that they can watch some of our bird hunting. And we obviously are really grateful for the partnership that we've had with Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever for many years. It used to be Pheasants Forever Television before I was even involved, and now it's been The Flush for over 10 years, 12 years, something like that.
Yeah.
It's been quite a run, and you and I have spent many days in the field together. Hopefully we can do more again this coming season. But between you and I, we're both pretty busy during the hunting season. There's a lot of things happening out there in the field.
Well, let's talk first about a rundown for what's ahead on this season, which was your hunting season last year.
Yeah.
You've highlighted, and it's definitely a must-watch episode, A Boy's First Pheasant Hunt, which is Weston's story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your story, too.
Yeah, it's mine. It's our story, for sure.
That comes up on week 8, the week of August 19th. Kicking off the season, the week of July 1st, Alberta Huns and Fowl.
Mm-hmm.
And we go to the North Country. Superior Trail Rough Grouse, Legends of the Fall in North Dakota for Sharpies and Huns. Week 4, Minnesota's first CRP farmer. It's an interesting one. First.
Very interesting. And I'll jump in for just a quick second.
Yeah, go for it.
That was the gentleman who purchased or enrolled his land in the very first CRP contract, I believe.
In the state of Minnesota.
I believe it might have been in the country.
Oh, wow.
So, I'll have to watch that back to make sure I get my information correct on it. But that gentleman has had his land in since the very start of CRP in America.
Wow.
And he's kept it going, and it's all because of the passion for the land and the birds that we all love so much.
Our favorite.
And he's
program.
Got the most incredible mustache you might ever see.
Really?
Yes.
Raleigh finger style?
Yes,
really?
Exactly. Yep.
All right, let me run down these, and you can highlight a few more. So week 4, that's the Minnesota's first CRP farmers, week 4, July 22nd. Scott Franzen hosts a trip to Kansas for bobwhite quail in week 5. Week 6, Travis hunts with our new president and CEO, Marilyn Vetter, and her husband, Clyde, in North Dakota.
Can I jump in on this? Yeah, so that is a love story, Bob. That is an absolute
love story between Marilyn and Clyde, or the Vetters in North Dakota, or all of the above.
High school sweethearts. We went back home and we got to see where Marilyn grew up and her roots. And it, to me, is just one of those episodes that I'm really excited to share and honored to have the opportunity to share, honestly, to go back there, meet her family, and just to kind of sit in that space and see where she grew up. But I will also say this, and I told this to Marilyn when we were out there. She busts cattails like few men that I've ever hunted with. And you and I are not very tall guys. And she's you know, a few inches shorter than us even, too.
How tall are you?
I don't know, 5'7", 5'8", something like that.
Yeah, I'm right there. I think we're almost identical.
Yep.
And Marilyn is probably 5'2",
maybe
something like that. Yeah,
but you wouldn't know that by the way she pounds through the cover and busts through cattails. I mean, she busted cattails, like I said, like few hunters that I've ever seen. And I told her, I'm like, if anybody ever questions your drive as a leader, all they have to do is see how hard you hunt and bust through those cattails. And that says everything you need to know about Marilyn. I was very fortunate to spend a handful of days with her back at her home place where they fell in love with hunting and bird dogs out there and got to know her really well. And I'm really excited to be able to share that episode with people. Hopefully they get a glimpse of what their leader looks like in their own element out there, because she loves it just as much as we do. And she respects it probably more than we do. Mm-hmm. And that's a really powerful thing.
Yeah. It's not her job. It's her lifestyle.
It's her life.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That one comes up, let's see, week 6, August 5th. Then Bill Shercoke hosts one rough grouse and woodcock in Minnesota and North Carolina with a grouse guide.
Yeah.
Then, as I mentioned, A Boy's First Pheasant. That's your trip to North Dakota with your son. That's week 8. Week 9. Travis takes a trip with Pheasants Forever members to Iowa. Mm-hmm. Is that the show from a year ago?
It is.
That was a really, really good show.
That
was an auction hunt, right?
That was the one. Yep. We've done that in the past with you guys, and we've been able to help raise some money.
Significant amount of money.
Yeah. People have bid on that opportunity to go on a road trip with us, and we've done South Dakota, North Dakota, and Iowa. Mm-hmm. And then we hunt with different landowners coordinated by biologists in that area throughout the state. And it's been a really cool opportunity to meet people that love the show, that want to be a part of it, but also the landowners that invest so much into making their land wildlife heavens out there. And obviously it's an honor to be able to walk in those spaces and be a part of those shows, but to see it. And again, like I people ask me all the time, like, what are you going to remember, or what do you love most about your job? And I'm like, well, it's the amazing places I've been, but really it's the people that I've met along the way. And those shows really sum that up.
Yeah, that was a good one. That one will be rebroadcast this season on week 9, August 26th. Then from Triumph to Heartbreak, week 10, Idaho Hunt with Scott Franz.
Yeah.
And that's got that's a sad story.
It's a story we hate to tell, and we almost didn't, and almost – we really went back and forth with it. Mm. We think, you know, every time we walk into the field, we're invincible, and we're just not. And our dogs, Bob, you've lived this.
Yeah.
You know, things can happen out there in the field. And our TV shows, these are wild birds, wild places, and these are real hunts and real adventures. And we try to tell the stories about the realities out there. And the reality is that hunting dogs can experience tragedy out there, just like we could. Accidents happen. And an accident happened out there that definitely changed the lives of the people in the field. And therefore, we went back and forth on it. We decided after conversations with everybody involved that everybody wanted this to be shared. So I'm going to leave it at that as something that a story we hate to tell, but we feel like we must.
And it's pretty valuable that people watch it, because it's knowing the story, I just wouldn't have expected this to have happened. So
yeah, it's nobody did.
It's a really, really important one.
Yep.
For folks to watch, and you'll learn a lot.
And I just wrote an article for the Super issue, and I called it Riding the Wave. And it talks about some of the adventures that we go on this year. And there are highs and lows, just like every bird hunter has highs and lows in the fields. There's times where you're literally and figuratively on the highest points, you know. Yeah. Great things are happening, and sometimes you're in places that literally take you to those highest points on top of a mountain. And then sometimes you hit rock bottom and you wonder, why did I ever step foot in a field? I'm never doing it again. Yeah. What got me here? And you ride the wave, and it's the journey of a full hunting season. And that's really kind of what I think sums up this year for our TV shows, is we had some high highs and we had some low lows out there. And the reality, and I'll go back to, in Alberta, right out of the gate, second day filming for the season up on the high plains up there, and one of the dogs gets caught in a snare, a coyote trap. And I always carry a wire cutters with. And I was able to just calmly walk up and cut that cable and free the dog right out of there. But you just think about these things. I should say, a lot of people don't think about these things. And so therefore something simple like saving a dog really easily could turn into losing a dog out there if you're not prepared. And it's just a simple little Nipex wire cutting tool that goes in my vest everywhere I go. And I've never had to use it until that moment. But I included that in the episode because I think that's a reality that us bird hunters face anywhere we go. And, you know, it's just a reminder.
Yeah,
we left it in the show as a reminder that this can happen.
Yeah. It pays to be prepared.
Yeah.
Go from that tragedy in Idaho, week 10, to week 11, a story that came to fruition you and I talked about. So it's Travis and Ben Bredigan from Onyx do a late-season Northwoods, Minnesota rough grouse hunt. And you and I talked about it before. It's like, gosh, I think you and I talked like late November.
Yeah, like, might have been early December-ish, and we're like, somewhere in there.
Where should I film a, you know, rough grouse hunt? And who should I go with snow on the ground? And how are we going to find birds? Like, gosh, it's really tough.
It's a different animal, Bob. It is a different animal.
And then the snow never came.
Yeah.
And so you put a.
We had, it was white. We had snow on the ground.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yep. We had, it was the most bizarre winter. And actually, to take one step back, the reason that this ended up happening, I believe, I had a different hunt, and every year things happen, right? So we have a fishing show as well that we produce. And I, while filming this fishing show, got a fishing hook stuck in the center of my eyeball, Bob.
Oh, my gosh.
It literally flung up out of a fish's mouth and stuck in my eyeball.
And it went out of a fish's mouth?
Yep. This is early ice. We're in northern Minnesota, and we're filming an ice fishing show. And I lean down. You know, you lift your rod up as you lean down by the hole to grab a fish. And the hook, like a slingshot, shot out and went...
No kidding.
Literally, Bob, into my eyeball. And I've told this story quite a few times. I haven't shared it on, like, because I can't see where the hook is. I grab my phone out of my pocket, and I turn it on video mode and film so I can get a glimpse of where it is. And this other guy comes in. He's like, dude, it's in your eye. And it was the most uncomfortable thing. So you can't turn your eye because it moves the hook. You can't blink because it moves the hook. And we were a mile into the woods in this Northwoods lake in the middle of nowhere, an hour and a half from a hospital if we hustled, you know, and this thing was stuck in it. But anyway, the hook in the eye changed my plans drastically over that couple of weeks. And the doctor's orders were I could not hunt. I could not lift anything over 5-10 pounds. And then I progressed to heavier as my eye healed up. And so I was looking for a new, because I had to cancel my.
Hold on. I don't know any of this story. How is your eye today?
20/20.
How is that possible?
It's a miracle of God. It's the only way that I can describe it, Bob. So if you look at your eye, if you did a, you know, like if somebody put it up here and you peeled back all the layers of your cornea, there's five, and it's like an onion peel. You just keep peeling them back. The hook went into the dead center of my cornea, and it poked in at a weird angle. And the doctors that are specialists looked at it, and they're like, this will go down as one of the biggest bullets dodged that I will see in my entire career.
Oh, my gosh.
The way they were just fat. One, the eye doctor in Brainerd on the way back that day, he looks at it, and he just could not stop studying my eyeball in the lens that, you know, he's got me under this light, and he's looking. He's like, this is fascinating. Those were his words, staring at my eyeball under the microscope. And I'm like, what does that even mean? He goes, I don't know how you're not in extreme pain. I don't know how you can even see right now. And I can't explain it any other way. Our eyes are amazing at healing. They almost heal too fast. So they had to slow the healing process down so that the scar, imagine taking like a wedge and going into the eyeball. So they were afraid that it would heal too quick and there'd be a big scar. My vision was basically sliced in half. So for a while there, if I were looking out of this eye, my left eye, there would be two Bob St. Pierre sitting here. Mm-hmm. He would be one over here and one over here because my eyesight was sliced into two.
Wow.
And it was crazy how blurry and uncomfortable and all that stuff, but just how quickly it healed.
So no surgery, no, it just healed itself?
It healed itself.
That's unbelievable.
It is. They put some steroids in there so that it would slow the healing down so it wouldn't scar as bad and allow my eyesight to come back into one. And really monitoring it to make sure that there was no surgery needed, but it healed, and there was pain with it. I wore sunglasses inside because the next day I woke up and the brightness of it was like somebody taking a needle and just shooting it through my head. That's how much it hurt. But that went away after a couple of days, and I was able to slowly regain vision every day, a little better, a little better. And now if I do an eye test, I would get 20/20 on it. The last time I did one,
that's
remarkable. He's like, we'll do a 1-year follow-up, but you are a walking miracle here. And we prayed out there on the lake that it would heal, and my family was praying at home too. And I called my wife, and I was like, honey, I got a hook. I have been around fish. I have unhooked, I don't even know how many fish, yeah, Bob, in my life. I don't know if it's millions or whatever. I mean, my whole life I've been around fishing and unhooking fish and guiding people to fish. And I always wear sunglasses, always. And it's for that reason, because I had a close call about 20 years ago. And I had glasses on that day when somebody went to cast. It ricocheted off my glasses and pierced my eyebrow. And so, if I wasn't wearing glasses that day, I might not be able to see. And so I did not have glasses on this day ice fishing. And I didn't, because while filming, I need to be able to hear the people that I'm interacting with. And if I have my fishing sunglasses on, I can't wear my hearing aids. So I opted for hearing over the sun protection. It was a cloudy day, and I regret that decision. I learned something from it, just like walking through the woods, the brush, you know. But ultimately, it goes back to my hearing struggles, or not taking care of my hearing early in life, shooting guns, loud noises. I just, if I could go back and do things, and that's why with my kids, I'm your eyesight and your ears. As soon as you lose your hearing and your eyes, you know, you just, there was a moment there, I'm standing on the ice and I'm like, I might never see again.
Yeah, your whole life
changed. I couldn't see. And I go, did this just really happen? And I started to feel down on myself, if I'm being honest. I was just sitting there thinking, crap, I just lost eyesight in my eye. You know, like, it was a real gut punch moment there. And now to have it back, it's kind of like, you see these hearing aids right here that I took out for the headset. But I had lost my hearing so bad that before I got hearing aids put in, I would say like six, eight, seven, whatever. I walked outside that day with the hearing aids in, and I heard birds chirp. I heard sounds. And it's just like those videos when kids hear for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, I just stood there by myself outside and listened to these noises that I forgot about.
Huh.
Didn't know existed. Didn't hear a leaf crinkle. Didn't hear, because there's frequencies that I had lost.
Wow.
And so having hearing back is a real blessing. And so that's why I'm always trying. And I don't always do a great job of it. I'll be on TV without a pair of glasses on, and somebody will write me, and you're setting a terrible example. And I'm like, you're damn right I am. Dang it. I wish I was always setting a better example. But in those moments, sometimes, you know, you're sweating or whatever, you take this off, or I don't have 100%. I don't have everything perfect every time.
Sure.
For sure.
And that's how you ended up in northern Minnesota on a grouse hunt.
Anyway, yes, holy, so now we changed plans, and now I'm grouse hunting in the woods in December, the last week of the hunting season. And grouse, we hunt them, you and I hunt them, you know, that's my favorite bird to chase. Yeah. And as soon as I can get in the woods, it's usually too thick, but I don't care because you got to go. And then that October woods is just magical. And then when the snow flies, you know, things change up there, and I typically, I'm hunting pheasants and other birds out on the prairie, and I don't get to the north woods as much late season. I hadn't since college days, and so you and I were talking about it, and we made a run at it. We camped up in the woods, Ben and I did, and it was a different experience. Those birds were much different. We figured it out, but they were more like pheasants than grouse. They were running.
So that happened right after the eye injury.
Yeah. So that was the first week when the doctors gave me the green light. They go, you can't shoot. That would jar, too much of a jar.
Yeah.
And then also, I just couldn't lift anything to be too active. They didn't want me to strain it and pop anything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you notice anything on that hunt in terms of recovery?
It was good to be back.
Yeah.
Grateful to be.
Do you talk about that in that episode? The fish incident?
No, I didn't. Not in that episode.
It's pretty personal.
It was personal, but also with TV, we have to show things. You know, there's some stories that are made for paper, newspaper articles, and, you know, TV, you have the camera has to see something happening there. And so
action wins.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have video of that. And actually, I, you know, I didn't want to go there, I guess. Yeah. I think I do have some video of it. Yeah. The cameraman happened to be flying a drone when the fish hooked me in, or the hook came flying up, but you can't see it. I can show you a video if you want. I don't think you want to see it, but yeah.
Well, that, I didn't know about that element of the story. All right, so that Christmas Grouse Camp will air week 11, September 9th. We're down to the final two. September 16th, the Flush's annual Hank Hunt, number 3 at Prairie Wildlife in Mississippi for bobwhite quail. And you were on that hunt as well.
Have you met Mr. Jimmy Bryan?
He was at Pheasant Fest a couple years ago. He was our John Deere Farmer of the Year. Well, so I met him real briefly, but I don't know him at all.
Yeah, that guy is, he's a living legend. He really is. And the stories he told about the quail down there, I could sit for hours and listen. First, he got that southern drawl, you know, and it, and there's something, I don't know why, it's almost soothing to listen to somebody with that strong accent talk. I could only understand like 40% of what he said, though. It was a really thick accent, and I'm hard of hearing, so. But, oh, gosh, he just told stories and stories about the land and what he wanted to build there, and instead of going somewhere that had quail, he's like, no, I want to have quail here. So he's invested his life into bringing those birds back, and he has wild quail all over on his property. And what he really explained well was he's become like a quail farmer. To they'll go up to 25 miles. So a lot of the quail in the county all around him, they leave.
Gotcha.
Because they've expanding. Yep. So the quail from this covey will break off. They'll go over here, and then they'll go over here. And so they've tracked them. And he's like, we have quail that have left our property that are living 20 plus miles away, and they've radio collared. And so they know all this stuff. And so just think about where those quail then have gone.
Right.
All because of one man that has invested so much in bringing the right habitat back to his land. And now the results are, he goes, I'll go to church and somebody will come up and say, I got quail in my yard. And I want to thank you, Mr. Bryan, for making that happen.
That's pretty cool.
It is so cool. Yeah. So we got to celebrate dogs down there and hunt quail at maybe one of the finest bird hunting outfitters at, for sure in the South. Yep.
That's fun.
Yep.
And the season wraps up kind of where we started the conversation with the youngster.
Yeah, 10-year-old hunting phenom. Jace Newmarker is maybe one of the, I don't want to swear and say badass, but I'm going to anyway because he is.
How old is he?
10.
10.
And he has harvested more chucker and hard-to-find birds up in the mountains than most adults ever will. Already at the age of 10, and he's been hunting, I think, for 3 years now. Man, he's running dogs. He's got the GPS on his vest, and he's you know, he is keeping up. His dad is an excellent hunter as well, and he's introduced him. And so we go on a real wild bird hunt with those guys, climbing peaks of mountains above the clouds and hunting Hungarian partridge in the sage flats, and then the Huns are up in the mountains too, and then the chucker partridge up in the mountains as well, and they've got a cool little bird camp out in the middle of nowhere in Nevada. So I think you know, capturing his story is just like mine in that I love to be able to show people that you can do this early in life. Don't wait.
That's awesome. So weeks 1 through 13, we kind of went race through them.
Yeah.
But that's okay because you can go back and watch the full episodes. Outdoor Channel kicks off July 1st, runs through, as I mentioned, week 13, September 23rd, and then we'll rerun again.
Yep.
So this is the third quarter airing, 13 weeks, and then run through the end of the year as part of fourth quarter. And after they all air, just like all the other episodes from years past, you can check them out and at YouTube, simple search of the Flush, and you'll find all the episodes. Let's talk a minute about the year ahead?
Yeah.
What is on the horizon? What's changed for you? As Daisy's at my feet.
Yep, curled up here, mad that we're not hunting. Talking again, Dad. Talking again. This is not fun.
Daisy has gone from, I don't know, frustrating is the right word, but a mystery for you.
Yeah, very frustrating.
Now a source of pride.
Yeah.
An all around terrific bird dog. You know, before we hit record, you talked about maybe
I've got multiple puppy. I have multiple puppies on my cell phone right now.
So what's going on?
Well, I thought we want to add another dog.
Okay.
And
how many kids do you have?
Four.
Are you adding
and chickens?
Are you adding a puppy this year?
Well, I didn't want to.
Okay.
I wanted to add one next spring because I know that I'm going to be on the road a lot coming up here, and this right now is not ideal time for me to add a puppy into our family. Mm. And I'm nervous about adding that much to our family at this time, but I also really want another puppy.
How old is Daisy?
She's four.
Okay.
So she's at a point where, I mean, she is such a delight to hunt with most of the time. She, once in a while, still has that, because she's a big running dog. She wants to get out there. And every once in a while, she'll just, you know, push the boundaries too far. But for the most part, she's just really, really...
She's dialed in.
Dialed in. And I trust her. And if she stands on point for 10 minutes while nine kids come walking up, she'll do it. Mm. You know, I mean, I feel like the only reason we've been able to have such great success with those kids out there and then a lot of the other things that I'm doing too is because she's really has come into her own out there, and she will hold those birds and she'll go find them. And she is just a heat seeking bird finding missile out there.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's so much fun. And then you can see, this is her temperament here. She's just a sweetheart. And so I'm like Tyler Webster, you know, Tyler, you know, friend, we've been talking. I was like, I want another one just like her. And she's an Oops dog. She's a mixed breed, German Shorter and an English Setter mix. And so I've received plenty of feedback about mixing another litter. And Tyler doesn't want to do it anyway. But I want exactly what she is in a dog, because she curls up on bed between my boys at night. You know, they share a bed and she sleeps in between them. And she's just an all-out bad hunter to the bone, you know, like she,
in a good way.
Yeah. And like I mentioned, she'll go get the ducks, she'll bring back the geese, she hunts everything. She just has a bird drive that's crazy, and we've harnessed it, and so I love hunting with her. And now I'm nervous about being October 10th and if she goes down or something, not having a dog, a second one to let go, and also just to have, you know, another, as the miles wear on her over time, I don't think that she's going to be able to run 30, 35 miles a day for a week straight like she has been over the course of the last couple of seasons here, where we've really leaned heavily on her to go out and work. And I mean, she doesn't want to quit. She doesn't have that in her at all at this point. But I know that time is coming, and this is a perfect time to add another one to the family. So multiple puppies are sitting in my inbox, I should say, on my phone.
And what are you looking at?
I'm really torn, Bob. I'm really torn. I want her, you know. And so I'm looking GSP. I'm looking English Setter. I'm looking English Pointer. One of those three breeds.
Okay.
And I like... I've hunted, and this is something you've experienced this too. Mm. The ability to hunt behind a variety of different dog species, dog breeds. Yep. Sorry, not species, dog breeds. A lot of hunters, they hunt, you know, on the weekend with their buddy, and they might both have Britneys, and they know Britneys, that's it. Or they have Labs or GSPs or whatever. They don't exactly see dogs of different breeds hunting. And so, therefore, they don't exactly know what some of these qualities are and what a different dog will do. And so, they love what they see because that's what they see. But I have seen a lot of breeds in a lot of different habitats hunting for different birds. Yeah. And some of them just shine at this. And some shine at this. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's where I really struggle. It's like, oh, you're really good in this situation. You know, and you're really good. But I like the prairie. I like the woods, the North Woods for grouse. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really leaning English setter. Mm. I'm also torn because I really like the GSB.
Are you getting two puppies?
No, 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 not yet. Not yet. And then I also like, I mean, some of the best pure prairie bird dogs I've ever hunted behind are just pointers.
English, yeah.
English pointers. Yeah. I mean, they get it done yeah. out there. They just are. You can tell me that your dog is the best at this, yeah. your dog, but if you put five of them together, this dog in particular is going to go out and find 8 out of every 10 birds. Yeah. And I'll tell you.
And I know some of the people and their dogs you're hunting around too, right? George Lyle.
Yes.
Ben Bredigan.
Yes. Yes. Okay, the three of us run together pretty good. And
I can see how you're being swayed.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure.
So,
because they got great dogs.
Their dogs get it done.
Yeah.
And there's something about watching a dog that just flat out gets it done. Yeah. And I'm learning a lot about the different breeds too and how quickly some of them learn and how some of them take longer as well.
Yeah.
And that's, again, being around a lot of different breeds, I'm kind of like paying attention in ways that I hadn't paid attention to 5 years ago. So it's a lot of fun. And the idea of adding another little one to the pack is exciting. And I don't know that I'm going to pull the trigger here, but I might have a puppy before hunting season starts. if I choose with my heart, we'll have another puppy. If I choose with my mind, we're gonna wait till next spring.
Yeah. So you're gonna have a puppy this year?
Yeah, my wife goes, should we go look at them? I go, no, if we hold that little tiny puppy, yeah, there's no way we're going back.
There's
zero chance. That's,
especially if your kids are with you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. The cutest thing ever would be my little 2-year-old holding a tiny little puppy. There's no chance we could say no.
I don't think there's any chance you're going back as it is.
We'll see, Bob. We'll see.
All right. I know that you want to, annually when we do this podcast, you throw it out there for folks. Mm-hmm. That if they have a story that's made for television,
yeah,
how do they get a hold of you?
I mean, they can search any of the social platforms. Just search The Flush TV. I'm pretty sure we'll pop up there. TheFlush.tv is our website. There's a contact us form on there, and you can write out your own personal story on that. Basically, midsummer here, we take all of these ideas and we try to figure out how we can accomplish this during the hunting season. It's really short-lived, and that's why we don't always get 13 full episodes done. Like the Iowa one was filmed the season prior, and it's just because we have limited resources here. And so we're trying to do a full season, but like there's 25 places I want to be October 25th.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the woods are perfect late October, mid-October.
Right.
But we can only be really between myself, Scott, and Bill. And Ron Chair is still a part of it. You know, this is something he created before I was here. And we want to keep him out in the fields as long as we possibly can too. So we divvy it up. And I take a big chunk of the season. And then the others... Mm-hmm. Produce as well their own TV shows, and we try to make sure we're in all kinds of different places. If you notice our list, we're up in Canada, we're down in North Carolina, we're in Nevada, we are in North Dakota,
right.
Minnesota to Idaho,
right. Maine to Arizona. And part of that is seasons opening up in September allows you to knock down some episodes, mm-hmm. and then in January chasing desert quail allows you to knock down some episodes because you can't do them all.
You can't.
October 25th.
That's right. So we try to spread it out. We try to show a variety of birds. This is a show that airs in, you know, nationally, mm-hmm. and up in Canada. So we try to have that variety as best we can. So people, please send us your stories, because I have a running list, a big folder, and I go into it and kind of say, well, we've got 2 rough grouse episodes. We've got 2 sharp tails and huns. We've got 4 pheasants. We've got a chucker. We've got a couple of quail. We've got a variety. And that's always our goal, is to have a variety of places, a variety of bird species, and great people, great stories. And these are always, we try, Bob, always to have our Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever members. I mean, we're hunters just like everybody that's watching the show. And we like to hunt with the people that are out there in the fields. We hunt as best we can, all wild birds on a lot of public lands. It doesn't have to be public lands. People have great success stories, like the gentleman who signed the first CRP contract in Minnesota, you know, and so seeing that is part of the adventure that we go on. So I always tell people, you've got 3 days. Tell me, what does it look like if we come out and spend 3 days with you? And what do you want to hunt? Where? When? Who are you going to hunt with? Tell us your story, and help paint a picture. And then I can put a rundown together for a season. And maybe it's this year, maybe it's next year.
Yeah.
But I don't throw these ideas away. We just keep adding to them.
Well, thank you for being such a great representation of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. You tell the stories with humility and ethics, and you always keep conservation at the forefront, and it's sincerely appreciated. That's why, you know, we stay partners, because you're an embodiment of our members and who we are as an organization. So thank you.
I appreciate that, Bob. I love being friends with you and the team and being part of the family at Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, and that's how I feel, and you guys have always made us feel that way. And it's, you know, this is our lifestyle. This is what we love to do, just like you. And to be able to, as a production team, share these stories, it's really important.
Yeah.
And we are so grateful for the Upland community that enjoys this with us, that travels on these journeys with us, that stays in connection with us. They write stories and tell us, you know, how this might have affected them, or, you know, the fact that their wife hunts now because she sat down and watched my wife go out there and experience something for the first time. And to me, I hope we can keep telling stories as long as possible.
Well, one story that's must-see TV, folks, and we've talked about it a fair amount, a boy's first pheasant, Wesson's and Travis's story of their first hunt for pheasants together in North Dakota. It's week 8, August 19th. On the Flush, airing on Outdoor Channel. Those times again, these are Eastern times, Mondays 9:30 a.m., Wednesdays 12:30 p.m., Fridays at 11:30 a.m., Saturdays 8:30 a.m., and Sundays 6:30 a.m. Travis, thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, thank you for listening. I'm Bob St. Pierre reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.